Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disabilities who have taken from them or are denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those above them.
Disrespect welcomes John Harstone, a consultant helping housing groups develop affordable housing. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
We were talking yesterday about the drop-off in real estate values, which is far less in Canada than in the States, but nevertheless, it's really crimped Toronto style for developing social housing. Because they use condo fees. You mentioned that only Toronto and Vancouver are the two cities that you're aware of that do that.
Yes. I mean, one of the things about the amount of condominium development here and in Vancouver, they've been able to use monies generated by condos to essentially help with the development of affordable housing. And that's not something that's going on in most of the other cities in Canada.
Right. What we started talking about was what would happen to affordable housing in the rest of the country if this avenue is not open to them and government revenues go down, land values go down, and contractors start looking for other work.
Well, contractors are going to be starting to look for other work. We've got a whole downturn we expect in the Canadian construction industry. And in Toronto, I think we're predicting that there'll be, in sort of 2010, half as many construction starts as there were last year.
Okay.
But the question around whether the downturn is going to impact affordable housing, it's very expensive, and the government has to make some sort of financial contribution to get it built. And so the real key thing here is that getting a contribution from the government, either it can be the lower interest rates or it can be the form of a capital grant. And if the government has a program to do that, and the Harper government has promised to continue some of the affordable housing programs as part of their election campaign.
Well, they were more like homeless programs, weren't they?
There were homeless, but they also are
Skippy,
helping develop affordable rental and some affordable ownership as well.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I mean, they weren't big.
They weren't big, and there weren't a lot of units. But if those programs continue, the downturn in the whole general housing market will make it a little bit easier to build because land prices will be lower and the construction prices will be somewhat lower as well. So it'll make it a little bit easier to build.
Yeah, okay. So we won't be competing with hungry developers for land because they'll be nursing their wounds trying to sell the inventory that they have. And we won't be competing with them for tradespeople because their work is done and they're waiting for the economy to pick up again in the private market. So they'll be available for the public market.
That's right.
It could be a boon then for social housing, provided, as you say, the government funds are there.
That's right. Yeah.
Do we have any indication the government funds are there or will be there or will not be there?
Well, The Harper government did indicate that there would be funds made available for both homeless programs and affordable housing programs. The exact extent and the timing, I think, is still uncertain. I think we have to believe that it's going to happen. I think there is an enormous need for this kind of housing, and I think the government is going to certainly come forward with some sort of program, but the timing is very uncertain at this moment.
Okay. So the Harper government has continued a few programs. You think that we can count on them for some more, but we don't know how much and we don't know when.
That's right.
And the McGuinty government, it's hard to know whether to believe Dalton McGuinty or Dwight Duncan. Dalton McGuinty's backpedaling that we may have to slow down, and Dwight Duncan saying, well, we're not going to back off our anti-poverty campaign. So it's hard to believe which of them is telling us something closer to the truth. What do you think is going to happen in Ontario with funding? Because with just federal conservative funding, I can't see it happening. Can you?
Well, the federal conservative funding is linked into contributions from the province and the municipalities of some sort as well. Mm-hmm. So if the federal government comes forward with dollars, they're expecting Ontario to contribute as well. And so it's really contingent on Ontario.
Oh, so they'll twist their arm.
That's right. So it'll twist their arm. And how they give that money and how it's structured is still to be worked out. And I suspect there's going to be some very interesting negotiations between all levels of government.
Any of them scheduled yet?
Not that I know about.
So people have to keep their ear to the ground if they want to know what's going on.
That's right, yes. And there's going to be the activists who are in this area. I mean, they're out there sort of pushing and trying to get this thing to happen. But, they still have to name a cabinet and go on from there before there's going to be any real work on this.
Yeah, and then Christmas. I saw the article in the Star today by Armin Yelnisian and a couple of other housing economists, poverty economists, on the question of attacking poverty being more important with the pullback in employment and the stability of existing companies than it would be in good times, because the money is a flow through for everybody concerned. That you give the money to people with low incomes and it flows out into the market. I imagine that would also point to the advantage of affordable housing to stabilize these people's lives and put them in a position where the investment in their lives can flow back out into the market too. Am I right?
Absolutely.
Because I'm not an economist.
No. In fact, it's not even economics as much on some levels. It's just good sense.
Yeah.
If you can give people good, solid housing, mm-hmm. the benefits are, the indicators we've seen are improvements in health, mm-hmm. improvements in the school achievement by their children, improvements in income, because they're getting their housing stabilized, they're able to go out and get work. There's a whole range of improvements. The other thing that starts to happen is you give people better quality housing, they start having more pride in their neighborhoods,
mm-hmm.
you improve a general sense of safety in the community. There's been an enormous number of positive spin-offs for society by addressing housing.
So they're both short and long term, these benefits.
Oh.
The savings start now, but the savings grow into the future.
Well, that's absolutely the case. And particularly if you're dealing with sort of the people who've been homeless, a lot of those people are now using, for instance, services, hospitals, police, food banks, all of these services, which if you can stabilize them and get them into housing, can be provided at a fraction the cost if they're in housing as opposed to being on the streets.
Yeah, for sure. And some of those savings areas are excruciatingly important. The rumor that I heard was that healthcare has hit the wall expense-wise. And so anything that is, can save the health budget without cutting back on care is suddenly golden.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yes.
Yeah. Do either level of government buy this argument? I mean, I know activists do, and I know the people living it do, because they see the difference in their own health. But do either level of governments buy into the idea that they can save on the health budget by investing in things like housing and income stabilization?
I think, I can't say whether the governments do. I mean, there are certainly people, individuals in the government, who do, and there's certainly people in, for instance, the hospitals who are quite aware that you've got to work on getting the housing as a component of getting these people no longer to use the hospitals as emergency rooms as their family doctors.
Yeah, exactly.
So they certainly, in that sense, are people in the health system who are working towards trying to come up with a more rational approach to providing these services and seeing housing as part of an essential part of that service and solution.
Okay.
And now we'll take a short break. Tim Williams, 4-Day Train.
Up this morning to the whistle of the 4-day train. I got up this morning to the whistle of the 4-day train. And the blues fell on me like a shower of rain. If I can't have you, baby, rolling in my arms. If I can't have you, baby, rolling in my arms. I'll catch the 4-day train, leave this worn-out farm. running from the country, headed downtown, looking for some action, looking for what can be found. Running from the country and I'm headed right downtown. Looking for some action, looking for what can be found. Well, the downtown lights, they burn both night and day. All the downtown lights, they burn both night and day. And the downtown hustle, taking my money away. If they know you're from the country, they treat you like a fool. Hard to play the game when you don't know a single rule. If they know you're from the country, they treat you like a fool. And it's hard to play the game when you don't know a single rule. Four-day train, carry me if you please. Oh, four-day train, carry me if you please. Won't you take me home with my head between my knees? Next time I hear that four-day engine roar. Next time I hear that four-day engine roar. Gonna jump from bed, lock and bolt my door.
You've been listening to social housing developer John Hearthstone discuss the present and the future of social housing under declining revenues and falling real estate prices in Ontario.
So the cabinet federally has to be arranged, and then we have to get through the Christmas season, and that then we can expect, surprise, surprise, we can expect Stephen Harper to twist Dalton McGuinty's arm and maybe for some blandishments in terms of fairness funding for Ontario to get housing off the ground between the two of them. Where would people look for word of this? How would they, you know, be aware of the beginning and be and enable themselves? I think the most important thing is enable themselves to participate in, to advocate where it's most effective when the movement starts to happen.
Well, my hunch is that it usually becomes public when they're federal provincial, territorial ministers' meetings. The housing ministers get together periodically,
okay.
And those meetings are where these deals get hammered out. And so when they announce a meeting where they're going to get all of the ministers together, which is a big undertaking, that's usually meaning that this has finally gotten all the behind the scenes work is out of the way, and we're moving forward to getting some real action.
Okay, so when it's all set up, we have some money set aside, some programs promised. We've seen how long it takes these federal provincial initiatives to get off the ground, 4 or 5 years sometimes.
Absolutely.
The interval of another election. What do activists and people with an interest in social housing do in the meantime to improve the situation? You know, I mean, how do they move this thing along over the period of years that it takes to make to iron out the wrinkles between the province and the feds and make, you know, get shovels in the ground and see that they're not canceled by an incoming government? Perhaps by then there are still only holes in the ground, and we've seen that happen too.
I can't answer about whether we're going to be able to stop project from being canceled.
Yeah.
But in fact, one of the things which is happening right now is that we're still the affordable housing projects, at least in Toronto, there's a whole bunch of them that haven't started construction yet because it's taken so long just to get all of the approvals in place, all the funding in place and everything else. So they're not...
We're talking city approvals as
well?
Well,
city approvals, yeah. City
okay.
approvals, there's a whole... I mean, and OMB and things like that.
Yeah.
So that's... they're going to probably starting next spring, and they're going to take between 12 and 18 months to build. So in fact, we're looking at probably another 2 years for some of these projects. So many of the activists are involved are seeing construction and projects which are like 2 years away.
Mm-hmm.
So if in the next a year from now there was an announcement of a new program, people would say this is beginning to make some sense. Maybe we can push to get these programs in place so that when the projects we're working on now are built, we can get another bunch of projects, get them going as well.
And the programs you're talking about are which?
Well, the programs right now that are building housing, helping to build housing, is the Federal Provincial Affordable Housing Program, which is the Ontario government and the federal government are working together.
Okay.
To, and they've got a program which encourages affordable rental housing.
Really?
Yep.
And what's its nature? Startup costs?
No, it provides $70,000 a unit as a grant, up to $70,000.
Wow.
And they want to see the housing brought in at about 80% of the CMHC average market rents.
Now, okay.
I'm not sure what those rents are in Hamilton, but they're in Toronto, a one-bedroom average rent's about $900.
So you've
got to be 20% below that. Too.
Okay.
And so that's the kind of numbers that they're looking at. They've also would like targeted for people living with mental illness and women fleeing violence to be living in these buildings. So they're looking at housing providers who can help them meet their goals of providing housing to people who need it the most.
Okay, so that's part of this federal-provincial deal.
Yes.
And you mentioned there were other programs?
Well, there are some other programs that have been that are in process in the sense that there's been a federal government has a homeless partnership initiative,
mm-hmm.
which has been providing some capital grants. Now, that's not sort of, I guess that those funds have been allocated a number of months ago, mm-hmm. but there's a similar program to that one that's being anticipated under the new government as well. So there is programs are designed for dealing with people who are homeless, as well as programs designed to help people who are working poor, who need a decent housing, having a hard time finding a place to rent.
Which is the one that's in place, and which is the one that's anticipated?
Well, they're in place in the sense that they've all been funded and all the funds have been allocated,
right.
And they're being built. And we're anticipating there'll be extensions of both of them.
Oh, extensions. Okay.
Yeah,
when do those come?
Or that they would be considered new programs. I mean, every government,
yeah.
you know, comes up with a new name for the program.
So did the old ones expire with the last term?
That's right. Essentially what happens is they need to find another tranche of money for it. And so... And inevitably.
So with the incoming government, then there's an extension or a reestablishment of these programs.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now the first program was the federal provincial partnership.
Federal provincial program.
Okay,
yeah.
And the second one.
Federal provincial affordable housing program.
Right.
And then the other one was the homelessness initiative or homelessness partnership initiative.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
And those are both federal provincial programs.
The homelessness program is a unilateral federal program. The province is not required to contribute.
Oh, okay. And is the province contributing?
To that one?
Yeah.
No, but they do provide funds in other ways to address the same group of people who are homeless.
Okay.
I mean, they've got through Ministry of Health and CommSAC, they're doing all sorts of supports, but there isn't a specific one that might be developing housing that the province has got. But the feds do have one.
Okay, so our hope in the short term relies on the extension of these limited but successful existing programs, and our hope in the midterm lies in an increasing availability of land and labor, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And our hope in the long term?
More funding programs. But
okay.
Also, I think...
So the success of these programs making a case...
Yeah.
The success of these programs making a case for more.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I also think it's going to rely on creativity and... the people who are developing this kind of housing coming up with cost-effective and creative solutions to get the best bang for their buck, because we're going to be looking at a time in the next 5 years where I think every cent is going to be scrutinized pretty carefully.
Yeah. And you say cost-effective and creative solutions, you're thinking of things like... I don't know, I'm just going to throw out some ideas. Brownfields, tax repossessions... existing underused city land, existing underused provincial or federal land? Is that what we're kind of thing?
You could say that. I mean, we're already using building on brownfields,
okay.
which, by the way, is usually really hefty price to clean up, and working on city and federal lands, so provincial lands. That's all happening.
Yeah.
The kind of things which I would be thinking about would be, for instance, there may be ways in which there can be... We've got thousands and hundreds of thousands of units of this type of housing already.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps it's
Which type?
Of the affordable housing here in Ontario.
Yeah.
And perhaps it's useful, it's about time we thought about looking at the asset base that's there and seeing if there is a way, instead of being entirely dependent on the government, to come up with ways in which we as a social housing sector can use our own resources to lever some of the costs to help keep those costs down, get more housing built for the same amount of government dollars.
At assets, you mean existing housing?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are billions of dollars in assets owned by...
And you're saying that the equity in those assets could be used as a lever.
That's right. Oh, absolutely. And
okay.
It's one of the things right now that that there's been reluctance on the government to let that equity be used for new developments. And I think it's time to look at ways in which we can creatively access that equity without putting groups at risk or projects at risk, but in fact enabling that cash to be used to develop housing. In fact, in Britain, a lot of the new housing, affordable rental housing built, uses the equity on the older stock that's been around for 20, 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's actually very common in Britain to develop new rental, affordable rental housing that way.
Okay. All right. So for you, the future looks bright. Can we follow, this sounds like an internal process within the development industry. Can we follow the progress of that initiative to leverage existing stock? I mean, one of the things that came to mind, and it doesn't fit quite the description that you gave, was the mayor's, Mayor Miller's Toronto initiative to make more efficient the existing stock of towers in Toronto, which towers has a greater supply than anyone except New York, apparently.
Well, on the continent, Toronto got more high-rises than any city but New York, and there's only 9 cities in the world with more high-rises than Toronto.
Okay.
So it's quite funny. Yeah, that what he's doing is really going to be selling it to private sector. This is private sector stuff. These are buildings built by the private sector in the 60s and 70s, at a time when there was lots of services in Toronto being rolled out along the major arteries.
Mm-hmm.
And now, 30 years later, what we've got are old concrete buildings, really solid buildings. And the analysis shows that if we could come up with cladding to make these buildings more insulated, the cladding itself will pay for itself in a fairly short period of time.
Goodness.
And they're hoping to reduce the carbon footprint by about 5% by just recladding and making these buildings more energy efficient. Yeah, it's a very exciting proposal by the mayor.
Yeah, but apparently endangered, right, in the meantime?
Well, it's endangered, yes, in the sense that there's an economic slowdown. But the key thing here is if it makes sense economically to the building owners to do it, they can make the case that...
Regardless of the economy.
Well, yeah. And if oil prices go back from 70 to 120 bucks a barrel, we're going to see everybody jumping back on to do more insulation. And so, in fact, if those prices continue to rise, you may see lots of private owners saying, we're going to have to do this in order to keep this building from breaking the bank. So we may find that the economics will pay for itself of doing this. But it's a very exciting proposal.
So is there any way to follow that except the newspaper?
Yes, there is. There is the firm that developed this. Actually, it's a heritage architectural firm, ERA Architects, here in Toronto.
Yeah.
And they started this tower renewal project by looking at these older 1960s buildings as part of our Toronto heritage,
which,
we're all used to seeing people go back to the Victorians, but here they were looking at what do we do about this. And they're the ones who started the renewal project, and they've got it on their website. It's ERA Architects here in Toronto, and if you Google them, you'd find it. And you could certainly follow what's going to be happening with the renewal project probably there. And I suspect the City of Toronto will also have a web page up.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So you think on both these websites there might be information.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think that once this starts to happen, it's going to be like all sorts of other things. I mean, that the heritage community did, like, doors open that will be, other cities will be picking up really quickly. So I think you'll find you know, if it works in Toronto, it's going to work everywhere else in Canada.
Well, that's true. I mean, it's not as if they didn't have towers in Vancouver, for
that's
sure.
That's right. Well, and even Hamilton's got quite a few.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I hadn't noticed that as a function of the housing market in Hamilton, but you're probably right.
Well, you know, when I think about places like, you know, Robinson Street, Herkimer, and things like that, I mean, I think about Charlton along there. There's quite a few high rises. Bay Street, you know, they've got quite a bit of high rise there.
I appreciate that. Was there anything that you wanted to say about the future of housing in the downturn and the mechanisms we have in place and are trying to develop to assure more housing for people who are undoubtedly going to end up homeless or very close to homeless in this economy? Anything you wanted to say?
No, actually, I think we've said a lot of it. I think the key is for people who are doing this kind of housing, who are committed to it, to be working with the government and other community organizations to come up with good proposals to develop the kind of housing we need, and creative and cost-effective proposals to make the best uses of our resources.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Well, hey, I really appreciate your coming on the show today, talking to us about this. I mean, it seems pretty simple when you look at it, but there are many different facets of it, and having you lay them out for us and explain the relationship of them, I think it's really important to the listener and certainly been interesting for me.
Okay. Well, you're welcome.
Thanks, John.
Okay. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to social housing developer John Hearthstone discuss the present and the future of social housing under declining revenues and falling real estate prices in Ontario. Disrespect news. Since our last cast 2 weeks ago from the Star, Wednesday, November 5th, letters to the editor, disability label needs to be broader. This is a comment on the article Rocky Road for the Disabled, October 29th. David Lepofsky's article conveys the discrimination persons with physical, mental, learning, and sensory disabilities confront across transit, technological, employment, and bureaucratic systems that perpetuate poverty. But he fails to acknowledge the growing number of people, especially women, living with chronic health conditions that fluctuate in visibility and degree of impairment. Advocating for a barrier-free society must include eradicating the cultural ignorance that oppresses those of us whose disabilities are not readily visible, but which demand equal priority and accessibility. So let's start to think about, for example, more physically convenient and accessible washrooms, rest areas in grocery stores, flexible working conditions and schedules in recognizing human rights across a fuller spectrum of disabled embodiment. Now, you must think pretty highly of the titles we choose because you rarely email us, but we think more highly of your comment. So email us at dialogue@inbox.com, dialogue@inbox.com, and let us know what you'd like to hear more about. Would you like us to look into that? The Spectator. Grandparents get support from city in benefits fight. Earlene Weaver said she was too old to be nervous before her last-minute meeting with the mayor. Riding up the escalator at the convention center, the 70-year-old grandmother who's raising her son's three young children said she wasn't worried either. I have too much hope. Weaver, co-founder of Raising Our Children's Kids, ROC, has been fighting for financial support for grandparents raising their grandkids for 3 years. The Hamilton-based group had scheduled a rally in Gore Park to oppose the McGuinty government's interpretation of the rules on temporary care. Under new provincial guidelines, the temporary care allowance would no longer apply to caregivers with a more permanent living arrangement or to anyone who has obtained legal custody of the children. Hamilton East Stony Creek MPP Paul Miller raised the issue in the provincial legislature and, with the group, asked the mayor to help them in their cause. Mayor Eisenberger said he'd send a letter to Premier Dalton McGuinty about the issue. He also said Joanne Priel would bring a report on the issue to City Council in the hopes of building support to pressure the Ontario government. Temporary care allowance provides $231 per month for the first child and $188 for each additional child. The grandmothers make a good point, Eisenberger said. They're doing a wonderful thing for these kids. I think appropriate support should be provided to them by the province. Miller said he was apprehensive about the city's pledge of support. We want to see results, he said. We don't want talk. I want to see the city get behind these grandparents. Here's something that indirectly impacts on people who are disadvantaged. Secrecy shrouds the hunt for city manager Andrew Dreschel in The Spectator. Curiosity at City Hall is rampant because the top bureaucratic post, city manager, has been vacant since July, and the expected hire date of mid-October has come and gone. Councillor Russ Powers, chair of the search committee, isn't saying much other than they are getting close to making a hiring recommendation to council. "We've gone three cuts, and we're in the process of just finalizing and conducting the final interviews," said Powers. He won't say how many are on the short list. Everyone is concerned about anything being leaked. It's believed there are half a dozen or fewer contenders still standing from the 12 who were picked to be interviewed in September. It's a safe bet at least one internal candidate still has a good shot at being the new city manager. In all likelihood, more than one insider has probably made it down to the wire. Three current senior managers: Scott Stewart, General Manager of Public Works, Tim McCabe, General Manager of Economic Development and Planning, and Chris Murray, the Director of City Housing, threw their hats in the ring. It's believed, though unconfirmed, that Joanne Priel, General Manager of Community Services, also took the plunge. Now, if you like the way Joanne Priel has managed poverty in this city, by all means, write a letter to Russ Powers in support. If you don't like it, maybe it's more important that you write a letter or an email to Russ Powers. That's up to you. We just bring you the news and indicate its relevance. I don't have a date. Recently, Martin Mittelstadt, environment reporter, Ottawa, to revive supplement safety bill. Health Minister Tony Clement plans to reintroduce controversial legislation giving the federal government more oversight regarding the quality and safety of supplements, vitamins, and other natural health products. A spokeswoman for the minister, Larissa Whaler, said that Ottawa intends to go forward with new safety proposals to cover the booming and poorly regulated supplement field, but didn't offer a timeline. The decision is likely to cause another pitched battle within the natural health products industry, where one major player, Jameson Laboratories, issued a public call for stricter regulations. Read restrictions for stricter regulations. And if you want more restrictions on the supplements you're able to take when your doctor tells you there's nothing they can do, write Tony Clement and tell him he's doing a great job. Otherwise, write Tony Clement and tell him to get his finger out of your expletive deleted. Globe and Mail, the Robert Zakansky case. Delays in drawn-out procedure turn justice system into a farce. The length of time it takes to investigate and get cases to trial in Canada is ridiculous. Once a case does get before a judge, lawyers, good and bad, can drag trials out for years. Conrad Black would likely still be a free man if he'd been tried in Canada because the case would still be going on. Everyone is now focusing on the length of time it's taken for the RCMP to complete its investigation into the Zakansky death. The underlying suspicion is that it's taking so long because the Mounties are trying to find a way to get their guys off. Polls have shown that Canadians don't completely trust the RCMP to undertake a neutral, unbiased investigation into its own people. Before Mr. Zakansky, there were other deaths in BC involving police officers, and they took about the same amount of time for the RCMP to investigate. When asked why it takes so long for the RCMP to investigate these cases, Force spokesman John Ward said at the time of the investigation, on behalf of Ian Bush, the young Houston, BC mill worker shot in the back of the head by an RCMP officer in October 2005, "They take long because they take long." No one is auditing these investigations. There is no credible third party that can tell us that the Zakansky investigation is no different from a million others. Personally, I'm sick of hearing people complain about this stuff because that's all we ever do in Canada. Complain and bitch and whine. And when nothing happens, we shrug and look perplexed. It's pathetic. That's Gary Mason in the Globe and Mail. I hope he's not talking about you or me. Would you like to know more about this? Dialogue, D-I-A-L-O-G, at inbox.com. The Fairness to Hamilton campaign, with a lobbying committee behind it, has been quietly pushing politicians for 5 years to reverse the effects of downloading social service costs from the province to municipalities. Pencils ready? In March, the campaign launched a website, fairnesstohamilton.ca, within myhamilton.ca, to educate residents about the cost of downloading. Since then, Tom Cooper, committee chair, says the group has sent candidates in the 2008 federal election a document outlining funding shortfalls from the federal government, presented a report that reviews the implications of downloading to local MPPs in 2007, presented the same report to all municipal candidates in the 2006 election in a community meeting such as Ward Town Halls, held a media conference in 2006 that included former Mayor Larry Deani and Terry Cook, two key figures who warned Mike Harris that downloading social services would spell disaster.
organized a letter-writing campaign in 2005 to Premier Dalton McGuinty, asking the province to rethink excluding Hamilton from social service pooling, from which Toronto benefited. The city committee is unique in that it's made up of councillors as well as community members, such as Mark Chamberlain with the Hamilton Civic Coalition, Cooper, and Chamber of Commerce Executive Director John Dolbeck. When asked about tangible campaign results, Cooper points to the fact that Hamilton has received $75 million since the campaign started. He feels that it is due to the advocacy of the committee, the mayor's office, and the city council. Business professor Marvin Ryder argues the lobbying has indeed worked. However, he says the website has a long way to go, buried as it is deep in the recesses of myhamilton.ca. Monday, October 27th, Too Many Reports Shelved, Critics Say, by Tracy Tyler. An article called Waiting for Justice, or at least a continuation of the article called Waiting for Justice. Crime Victims Are Waiting for Justice, and the report was by Roy McMurtry, delivered in May 2008. Legal aid clients are waiting for justice, and the report was delivered by Michael Treblecock in March 2008. And Access to Justice is a Problem in the report by Coulter Osborne, the date delivered June 2007. Would you like more about that? Dialogue@inbox.com, your one stop for all the things that drive you nuts and make you poor and make you laugh, too. Stuart Laidlaw, Faith and Ethics, reporter in The Star. The socialization of doctors to evil did not begin in Germany. A Holocaust Education Week gathering heard this week. And it didn't end there either. In fact, we hear echoes of it to this day. Even in Canada and other Western nations, doctors are regularly called on to help decide who gets medical care, such as kidney dialysis or expensive medication, and who doesn't, Abel said. A report in the New England Journal of Medicine in September found that the U.S. Army continues to use doctors in its interrogation of suspected terrorists, despite every major medical association condemning the practice. Can doctors' rules lead to questions of who is unfit for treatment and who deserves access to society's scarce resources? The kind of questions that lead to eugenics and euthanasia. Not repeating the mistakes of the past will require always seeing patients as people and not, quote, cases, and never making such life and death decisions lightly, Abel said. We need to not be cavalier about any decision we make. He also called on medical schools to teach a little less science and more ethics and humanities. Now, there's a conference going on as we speak, the Winnipeg National Symposium on Deathmaking. And I've been informed of this by not dead yet Stephen Drake. I have a call into him. It's kind of hard to track down while he's in Winnipeg, but I'm hoping that we can talk to him and we can get an interview. If you want that interview, let me know. Dialogue@inbox.com. From South Korea, the exclusive right of blind to be masseurs is upheld. The Constitutional Court backed the exclusive right of the visually impaired to be licensed masseurs, despite arguments that the law infringes on free employment rights. The arrangement was passed into law in 1912 to help ensure the blind held a livelihood, said the Korean Association of Masseurs, which has about 7,100 visually impaired members. Queen's Park Bureau, Toronto Star, Tanya Talaga. People with disabilities who need help to bathe, eat, or perform daily tasks are waiting 4 to 10 years for attendant services from the province, and that is simply inappropriate, says a progressive conservative MPP. It is time Ontario added attendant services to the wait time strategy so delays can be brought under control with funding, said Ted Arnott, Wellington Halton Hills. The strategy monitors cataract and cancer surgeries, joint replacements, some cardiac surgeries, and magnetic resonance imaging. Arnott's private members' resolution passed in the legislature. This now needs to be paid attention to come budget time in March, Arnott said. Eliminating the wait would cost $73 million over 5 years, but would save money elsewhere, he said. People with physical disabilities or spinal cord injuries languish in hospitals and long-term care facilities while waiting for attendant care, said Arnott. Care can be given at home or in supportive housing. There is no central wait list for attendant care in Ontario. It's estimated 6,000 people receive service in the community, such as supportive housing and attendant care at home, while another 6,000 are waiting, according to the Ontario Community Support Association. Some people with disabilities have died before getting to the end of the list, said Susan Thorning, CEO of the Ontario Community Support Association. Some good news for you towards the end of the year, passed but not proclaimed. The new Federal Registered Disability Savings Plan. If you're a younger adult with a disability or the parent of a child with a disability, this is good news for you. The Canada Disability Savings Plan is a registered disability savings plan, a program designed by the federal government to assist people who qualify for the disability tax credit, to accumulate funds on a tax-deferred basis along with additional government assistance. The first benefit is the opportunity to accumulate tax-deferred savings to shelter up to $200,000 over the disabled person's lifetime. The other primary advantage is the government assistance that's being provided, the Canada Disability Savings Grant and the Canada Disability Savings Bond. For family net incomes below $75,000 in 2008, there is a 300% match for the first $500 contribution. In other words, if you contribute $500, the government will give you $1,500. On the next 1,000, it's a 2-to-1 match. If you contribute an additional 1,000, the grant is $2,000. If your family income is defined as $75,000 or less, and you contribute $1,500, you're going to get a total of $3,500. Now, the savings bond's intended for lower and mid-income families. The bond is $1,000 a year to a maximum of $20,000, but is only paid in full if the family net income is below about $21,000. It's clawed back gradually as income increases. Families with net income over $38,000 do not qualify. RDSP assets and withdrawals will not impact other means-tested disability benefits in British Columbia, Saskatchewan, and Newfoundland. Quebec has announced its intention to do likewise. We're waiting to hear what the other provinces will do. Why should someone bother saving all this money and getting all these grants just to lose the beneficiary's provincial disability entitlement? And that's the Globe and Mail. Author Jamie Golombek, G-O-L-O-M-B-E-K, if you're looking it up on the web. There's lots more to it. If you want someone to talk to us about that, I can find them too. dialogue@inbox.com. And a sad note to conclude, 5 shot to death in homeless encampment. This occurred in the United States. 5 people were found shot to death in a homeless encampment obscured by heavy brush in the shadow of a freeway in Long Beach, California, police said. Detectives had not determined a motive or identified a suspect. Coroner's investigators were sent to the scene to identify the victims and determine how long they had been dead, Long Beach Deputy Police Chief Robert Luna said. You know the email address by now, dialogue@inbox.com. If you want to hear more about these stories, email dialogue@inbox.com for disrespect, and we will interview for the stories that you've told us are important to you. Now, disrespect concludes the show with our interview weekly with Cowder Ballooney, the blind immigrant musician, holed up in a room in a church in Montreal over 1,000 days awaiting the approval of his second application for immigration, afraid to leave for fear he'll be seized, sent to the United States, and deported from there to Algeria, where they're very aware of his situation and in the manner of developing countries may forcefully disapprove.
Yesterday I went to church.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
The mosque, right?
No, I said church.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I'm going every Sunday to church.
Okay.
And yesterday I went to church and I was lighting one candle.
Right.
For sick persons, you know.
Very good.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is somebody back in Algiers?
Excuse me?
This is for somebody in Algeria or somebody in Montreal?
No, to hold the sick in Canada and the world.
To what?
I make it for hold the sick here in Montreal.
Okay. All right.
Not Algeria, no.
Okay, good.
Yeah, but, you know, this is just this. For me, just symbol, you know,
Yeah.
For me, it's a good way, anyway, for everywhere in the world, you know.
That's right.
It's not for,
Yeah, good idea.
Yeah. Yesterday, I was talking to the woman. She's like Quebecois woman.
Yeah.
She was working for 8 years and they have a transportation.
In where?
And like for transportation.
Yeah. City?
Yeah.
Okay.
For transportation city, yeah. And kick her out.
She got kicked out?
Yeah.
Does she know why?
I don't know.
Okay.
They kick her out, and believe me, like, she went for welfare.
Yeah.
And she was depressed. She always suicide, and she's like, yeah. Oh. She was like, can you believe that after 8 years and a half?
Yeah, I can believe it.
She find herself...
yeah, without job.
Without job and without money, she went to welfare, you know? She doesn't have any employment, you know?
Yeah, and this is the worst time to look for employment. Right now, people are being fired everywhere. But but the city? Wow.
Yeah, the city, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the city. It's not... for 8 years and a half, she was working.
Yeah. That's sad, though. If you're born in... If you're Quebecois and you live in Montreal, you don't want to go outside the city.
Yeah.
And you certainly don't want to go outside the province.
No, the Quebecois, no.
No.
They like staying in Quebec.
I have an English friend who likes to stay in Quebec, too. He's been there for... I haven't spoken to him in 10 years, but he's been there for, oh, gosh, 20 years. 20? No, he's been there for 30 years. And he just likes the... He likes the culture. He likes the people.
Yeah.
He doesn't like English Canada as much. You know, even though he is from Prince Edward Island, but he finds the English culture is very bland, you know.
Yeah,
it's vanilla, you know.
Yeah. Now here it's very cute. If you're like everybody cool here, you know.
So you've been doing anything that I know about? You've been painting.
No,
you've been singing.
Next week I want to start to record my second album.
What are you going to do with your second album?
I want to start to record.
Oh, okay. Next week.
Next week, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Good.
And,
Did you... Have you made many sales of the first one?
Many what?
Sales. Have you sold the first one?
Not the first one. I didn't put... Yeah, I sold a lot, but I didn't put it on the market. I put it just like independent. But the second
free.
One...
Free. You put it free on the second,
yeah, but the second one, I want to put it on the market.
Okay. Oh, good. Do you have do you have some help?
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Yeah. All right. It's going to be more like just a poem.
Okay.
Yeah, and the music, and it's like music, then it's going to be guitar, piano, flute, drum, and
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Well, we'll figure it out when that comes when the sample song comes out on the web. We'll get a chance to hear it, or maybe you'll play us, you know, 30 seconds of each one, something like that on the web.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah. Buy the CD. Hear the samples.
But second, I want to do website for myself.
You want to do what?
Website.
Oh yeah. Can you do that by yourself?
Yeah, I want to try to do it with my friend.
Oh, okay.
Before I finish the second album, I put like just for music, you know.
Yeah. Okay.
Or maybe I want to put a link with the one my website.
Yeah.
To go direct to my music site.
Yeah. Okay. Sounds good. I've been talking to someone about a website. The only question is, where does the money come from for me? So I have not reached a conclusion yet, but I'm talking to someone about putting up a website for the show.
Uh-huh.
And somebody's mailing out my last interview, the one that I said I would send to you, and I haven't got around to yet, so I'll have to do that when we get off the air. But
okay.
Simon Black, the Montreal interview that I sent out, he's sending it around to different people. Oh, I guess it comes from his website, and this is now, he's got a link on his website. Click on the link below to listen to an interview I gave on the Disrespect radio program, 93.3 FM, with host Jeff Langhorne. Following my Toronto Star op-ed on the Montreal riots, Jeff and I discuss urban inequality, riots, and the economic crisis. So, yeah, I have taken the voice material out of that show and put it into an MP3. I may send you a 6-megabyte MP3.
Yeah. Okay.
Me, I'm just looking for a place to rest before Christmas. You know, I'm hoping... I know I'll get a break at Christmas time because no one will give me interviews. They're all out shopping.
Yeah, for sure. Like everybody, like...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So...
I can give you an interview.
Very good. Very good.
I have nothing to do. I'm staying here. And
yeah, Catter is out right now. He'll call you when he comes back. You know, please leave your name and number. I've never heard that.
I hope I'll be out. Nobody knows, but I can give you an interview too.
Yeah.
No, it doesn't make me what doesn't keep me. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know you're available.
No.
Yeah. Well, I hope we do have fresh interviews from you because people. People seem to like knowing how you are from week to week. It's different from hearing how you've been.
Week to week. Last week I was very sad, I'll be honest.
Yeah.
I was very, very sad. And today I feel good. Today I feel good. Yesterday when I left the condo, I feel like very good.
Oh, good. Okay.
Yeah, I eat a lot. I really feel like this is a go sleep.
Yeah.
That is the best way for me. When I feel angry, when I feel like tired, just like, you know, frustrated, just jump on my bed and sleep like half an hour, I'll be fine after.
Yeah.
Or if not, I'm going to do my exercise bike.
Yeah.
I took all my angry out.
Good.
Like today I was running.
Yeah.
My elliptical, I don't know what's the name of the machine, elliptical.
Treadmill? Yeah.
Like elliptical machine, like you're running with it.
Yeah.
I ran like 20 minutes.
Okay.
When you called me, and I feel okay.
Okay.
I feel, of course, when you took a shower and...
Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
So next week, you figure you'll know next Monday when you're going to be recording.
Huh?
You will know next Monday when you are going to be recording? What day, what time?
You mean the recording?
Yeah,
the music?
Yeah.
I don't know. But I have a meeting Saturday at 2.
Okay.
With the producer.
Yeah.
And we see what day we will figure. But he was ready to do next week.
Okay, good.
But I won't see him this Saturday.
Okay.
I had an appointment with him, and maybe we'll study maybe Monday, maybe, yeah.
Okay.
The one decided. We have 3 people, you know?
Oh.
Not only the
so
guy.
3 producers?
Yeah.
Okay.
Like one, it's not, yeah, the two is working. One, he took sound, other he took, you know? Like,
okay.
Yeah.
All right. Good. Yeah, yeah, sounds like it really has a hope of going to market, you know? That's great.
Yeah, but this one I hope is going to be very good. It's going to be more good than the first one.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, right. And the whole song that I wrote by my I wrote the whole song. I know what I'm doing now, and yeah, it's gonna be so good.
Oh, good. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, we'll look forward to
talking next week about it.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
All right. I'm glad to talk to you this week.
Take care.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Going out, musician John Stewart, in Justiceville.
Listen, from Los Angeles, a group of homeless people built a town of cardboard and plywood shacks on a vacant lot in downtown Los Angeles. They were evicted today and their houses bulldozed down. The city considered them a health hazard. They were moved, however, to the sidewalk 10 feet away where they remain today. Many of them were women and children. They called their town Justiceville.
Hey, mama. Have you seen the dream? Have you seen the highway where the El Dorado scream? Hey, mama, have you seen the dream? And hey, mama, did we ever light? Shine an orphan window in the middle of the darkest night. Hey, mama, have you seen the light? Yes, I have, and it's burning still. Oh, Justiceville, all they wanted was
to home, just as it is. A little place to call their own when no one can draw the stone. Just as it is.
If you'd like to be aware a day or two in advance of what the disrespect topic is, if we know a day or two in advance, we'll email you, but you have to email us first. Dialogue@inbox.com, dialogue@inbox.com, for your update on what's coming on disrespect. You can now listen to the show wherever you're near the internet. Disrespect is streamed live at http://cfmu.mcmaster.com. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at Showtime, Thursdays at noon, 93.3 FM, CFMU, to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.